this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Kwanzaa, according to Dr. Kuringa, who is the creator of it, he says that our African culture is the tradition, is the heart and soul of a principle called Kawaida. Kawaida is, this is our duty, to know our past and honor it.
What is Kawaida? Learn more about the living history and the formation of Kwanzaa with veteran community organizer and activist, Miss Molly Bell, straight out of Compton.
The art of being Black is often an acrobatic act in defending Black humanity.
We will hear an excerpt of Malcolm Jamal Warner's Art in Motion Juneteenth performance. Warner, also known for his iconic role as Theo on The Cosby Show, transitioned on July 20th, 2025.
Again, we began to see the educational process as being no more than a training process to keep people enslaved. And so, and ultimately, we began to view the political process in that manner as well. You know, the question became, what better way to enslave a man than give him the vote and call him free?
And we'll hear a discussion featuring the beloved Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, formerly H.Rap Brown, who was one of the many revolutionary leaders of the Black Power movement. Imam Jamil Al-Amin transitioned at 82 on November 23, 2025 at a federal medical center in Butner, North Carolina, due to reportedly an untreated illness while incarcerated. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Kwanzaa was created and born in the womb, work, and transformative struggles of the Black Freedom Movement. Dr. Maulana Kuringa, founder of Kwanzaa, says Kwanzaa was also shaped by a defining decade of fierce struggles for freedom and justice waged by Africans and other people of color all over the world. December 26, 2025 marks the annual celebration of Kwanzaa. The theme is Practicing the Seven Principles in Dimly Lit Times, Lifting Up the Light, Hurrying the Dawn. Fahima Sack, co-producer and host of WPFW's What's at Stake and Straight Out of Compton organizer and longtime West Coast community activist, Miss Molly Bell, tell us more.
Molly Bell, thank you for joining us here at Pacifica Radio.
Reparations in memory of our ancestors, and Abari Ghani to you, Sister Fahima. Abari Ghani, for those who don't, and me, what's the grand news? What is the good news? And thank you, Radio Pacifica, for allowing me to talk about Kwanzaa. First of all, let's just begin from the beginning. Kwanzaa is a week-long African-American festival, December the 26th to January the 1st. That concludes one year and begins another year. The festival comes from the East African Swahili phrase, Marunde ya Kwanzaa, which means first fruits of the harvest, and was established in 1966 by Dr. Saba Maulana Kuringa. And Saba means moral teacher, a leading theorist of African American history and culture. A cultural celebration, Kwanzaa has no ties to specific religious beliefs or practice. It can, however, be enhanced by individual faith practices and tradition central to the celebration of the Nguza Saba, or the seven principles of Kwanzaa. Let's begin with Nguza Saba are seven social and spiritual principles for everyday living developed by Dr. Maulana Kuringa. These principles deal with the way we relate to one another and the development of positive self and cultural images. That is awesome. Let's begin with the first one. The first principle is umoja. And umoja, and I'm doing it in this order, umoja is to strive to for and maintain unity in the family. Umoja, that is the principle of unity. The second principle is Kujichagulia, which means self-determination. to define ourselves.
And that actually is my birthday. I'm born on the second day of Kwanzaa, Kuji Chakalia, and actually self-determination pretty much describes my personality.
That is great. A lot of people can't say that. So it is to determine ourselves, to name ourselves, and create for ourselves and speak for ourselves. And I have to agree with you, that is you. The third principle is Ujima, which means collective work and responsibility. It means to build and maintain our community together and to make our brothers and sisters' problems our problems and to solve them together. The fourth principle is Ujamaa. Ujamaa means cooperative economics. Boy, we need that. To build and maintain our own stores, shops, and other businesses, and to profit from them together. The fifth principle is Nia, which means purpose. And I like those letters, N-I-A. I always say it means necessary I am. And it means to make our collective vocations the building and developing of our community in order to restore our people to their traditional greatness. The sixth principle is Kaumba, which means creativity, to do always as much as we can in the way that we can in order to leave our community more beautiful and beneficial than when we inherit it. And the seventh principle is Imani, which means faith. Faith to believe with all our hearts in our parents, our teachers, our leaders, and our people, and the righteousness and victory of the struggle. Now, when you're celebrating Kwanzaa, I want you to use some of these symbols. One is a mikaka, which is the mat. You put everything on a mat. The kanara is the candle holder, and you're going to put seven candles in them. In the middle of the candle is always the black candle, and that's for what? Unity. That stands for our people. And then on the right, looking at it, on the right side of it is the green candle. You'll have three. And on the left side of it, looking at it, you'll have red. And those are the seven principles. And each day you take the black candle and light the candle for the very next day. Always light them with the people. The people has to do everything. And then we also have food like the ear of corn, kiumba, you know, which is the unity cup. On the first day, we drink from a cup. That's a unity cup. And we all take a little sip from that same cup. And that's very important. And of course, there's the mazo, which is fruits and vegetables. And then there's zawaidi, which are gifts. The gifts that are given to us by our family and friends, they're not toys. They are things that will enhance us, like books to read. I guess now that we're in the 21st century, videos that are positive. Give them things that are positive. We're not looking for bikes and skates like that. Those are the ones that they want. Now, Kwanzaa, according to Dr. Karinga, who is the creator of it, he says that our African culture is the tradition, is the heart and soul of a principle called Kawaida. Let me just share with you the principle of Kawaida. Kawaida is, this is our duty, to know our past and honor it, to engage our present and improve it, and to imagine, and some of you have great imaginations, and to imagine a whole new future and forge it. That word forge is not a word I use a lot, but to forge it in the most ethical, effective, and expansive ways, forging our future in righteous, relentless struggle. And then we have to remember, some people says, well, we can't do all of that. That's kind of hard. Well, Nelson Mandela said, it always seems impossible until it is done. Those are the principles. And Dr. Karinga asked us just to remember that culture is our totality of sensitivity and celebration. And that includes religion, history, social organizations, economic, politically, shared wealth, shared good of power, power to bring good into the moral world for which we stand. So this is just a short emphasis on Kwanzaa and what it's all about. And I asked you to celebrate it. And when you end Kwanzaa, we always say Harambe, which means pulled together. Abari Ghani is what's the good news. And we always end everything. Let's pull together. And I close by saying the way I close out here, all you prayer warriors out there, you know what you've got to do. You've got to keep fasting and praying because the struggle continues. But always to God be the glory. Thank you, Sister Fahima. Thank you, Pacifica Radio. And you keep on Pacifica Radio doing the great things that you are doing.
Well, Molly, I just want to give people the website for the US organization, www.us-organization.org. If you want to get more information about Kwanzaa and the organization that founded it, and please log on to that website. Thank you so much, Molly Bell.
Asante sana.
That was Miss Molly Bell, activist and organizer, straight out of Compton, in conversation with WPFW's veteran producer and host, Fahima Sek.
Feel the joy as we sing of the love togetherness can surely bring emotion. Set the table, matter strong, thankful for the first fruits of the year. Stay, I light a candle just for you. Come join the party, it's a celebration. Karamu at Kwanzaa time of year. Red and yellow, black or white, your own, it's alright. It's a celebration that should last throughout the year.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Happy Kwanzaa.
There's so much we can do.
Alright.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Together there is so much we can do.
That was a classic by Teddy Pendergrass, Happy Kwanzaa. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. According to the official Kwanzaa website, this year's annual Kwanzaa theme, Practicing the Seven Principles in Dimly Lit Times, Lifting Up the Light, Hurrying the Dawn, is to speak on the falsehood, fear, chaos, confusion, and uncertainty that has emerged in this historical moment. Kwanzaa's cultural message speaks to the best of what it means to be African and human in the fullest sense. Here is Dr. Maalana Karinga, founder of Kwanzaa.
Kwa niaba ya jumuiya yetu, yani us, na watetezi wake, tunasema habari gani, karibuni ndugu na dada, rafiki na wageni. Miongoni mwetu siku zote mtakuta jamaa yenu na mahali pa amani. Na tunawatakia baraka bila idadi na vitu vyote vizuri bila mwisho. That is to say, on behalf of our organization, huh? And as advocates, we say greetings and welcome, brothers and sisters, friends and guests. Among us, you will always find your family in a peaceful place. And we wish for you blessings without number and all good things without end. Moreover, we bear witness as an African people that as our beginning was great and good, so shall our development throughout eternity be if we dare struggle, speak truth, do justice, and walk in the way of righteousness. Hotep, Ashe, Hedi. And how do we as a people honor our role as a moral and social vanguard, not only in this country, but indeed in the world? In a word, what are our moral obligations to ourselves and others, to the poor and the less powerful, to the vulnerable, to the oppressed, to the suffering and struggling peoples of the world, and to the well-being of the world itself. Constantly following in the culture footsteps of our ancestors and elders, we come together also to celebrate the good in the world, I repeat, the good in the world, the good of family, of community and culture, the good of loving kindness and care, the good of respect for ourselves and others, the good of life and love, of sharing and togetherness, the good of working to build and sustain the good world we all want and deserve to live in and leave as a legacy to those who come after us. Kwanzaa is above all a celebration of African people, right? It's very important for us to understand that Kwanzaa is above all a celebration of African people, a celebration of their lives, their culture, their historical initiatives, and the awesome march and movement we make to history. Indeed, on one level, it's also a celebration of our people in struggle, who have created a culture and history of struggle to free themselves and to be themselves and to bring an increased good in the world. Kwanzaa is an act of freedom, a liberating return to our own history, not requesting approval for our return or recognition of our holiday. It is an act of freedom against the culture imperialism of the dominant society, which sought to strip us of our African culture and make them darker images, make us darker images of themselves. It is an instrument of freedom, a means of building a culture of resistance. Kwanzaa was conceived as an instrument of struggle to raise and cultivate the consciousness of the people, to unite them around principles that anchored and elevated their lives and involved them in the struggle to be themselves and free themselves and build a just and good world we all want, work for, and deserve. It's an act of freedom, it's an instrument of freedom, and it's a celebration of freedom, a freeing of ourselves and being ourselves in radical rupture. It is a celebration of our culture, our history, and our humanity, and our awesome march and movement through time and space in the world. And we know that if we are to honor and achieve the task assigned us by both history and heaven, we must embrace principles and engage in practices which enable us to complete them. And at the heart of those principles are the Nguzo Sabe, the seven principles of Kwanzaa, and of Kawaida philosophy, from which both the Nguzo Sabe and Kwanzaa are created. I created and offered the Nguzo Sabe as principles and practices central to the liberation and bringing good in the world in 1965. These are essential ethical values, my people, and principles of life and living. And those principles are Umoja, unity; Kujichagulia, self-determination; Ujima, collective working responsibility; Ujamaa, cooperative economics; Nia, purpose; Kuumbu, creativity; and Imani, faith. Kwanzaa, through its rootedness in Kawaida philosophy and the Nguzo Sabe, like all significant messages and events, has both a particular and universal message and meaning. Like the great faith traditions of the world, it speaks first to the particular people who crafted it out of their own lives, out of their own lived experience and deep thought, and in its ability to speak to the best of what it means to be African and human in the fullest sense. Kwanzaa also carries a message for the world, and this message is clear and compelling in the Nguzo Sabe. And certainly one of the most significant ways to raise up and reaffirm the Nguzo Sabe is through the Kwanzaa Katina lighting ceremony. This ceremony, called Lifting of the Light, at last reflects the Sabaic teaching found in the Hosea of ancient Egypt, the sacred text of ancient Egypt, that says we as a people are, quote, given that which endures in the midst of that which is overthrown, unquote. And that this enduring legacy is our spiritual and ethical values. And so at Kwanzaa, we lift up these lasting values which light the path to bringing good in the world.
That was Dr. Mialana Karinga, founder of Kwanzaa. The theme for this year's celebration is Practicing the Seven Principles and Dimly Lit Times, Lifting Up the Light, Hurrying the Dawn. Dr. Karinga states, the lesson of our history and our sense of humanity tells us we must defy the darkness and darkness makers that work to dispirit and diminish us, and demonstrate a radical refusal to be defeated or dispirited in any way. Visit the official Kwanzaa website.org to learn more.
It's a holiday, come on, celebrate and rejoice.
It's Kwanzaa.
Spreading unity in our families and communities. Together to celebrate this season of Kwanzaa.
It is Kwanzaa. It's time to celebrate Nguzo Sabe on this day. Because Umoja, Kujichagulia, Ujima, Ujama, Nia, Uba.
A Kwanzaa song, by Lovely Hoffman. That was music by Buckshot LaFunk, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, featuring Maya Angelou with a mix of musical genres including Fela's classic Afrobeat. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Makua Holt. Malcolm Jamal Warner was born in Jersey City, New Jersey, on August 18, 1970. He was named after the iconic leader Malcolm X and jazz pianist Ahmad Jamal. He was raised in Los Angeles and later graduated from the Professional Children's School in New York City. In addition to his memorable role as Theodore Huxtable on the popular television program The Cosby Show, Warner starred in a number of shows and films such as Malcolm and Eddie, The Tuskegee Airmen, Read Between the Lines, and other notable projects. In 2017, Warner released You Can't Hear Me, a compelling spoken word short film featuring poetry that examines social justice issues in the U.S., including systematic oppression, deportation, and mass incarceration. Warner sadly transitioned at the age of 54 while with a group learning to surf in Costa Rica on July 20, 2025. Here is an excerpt of Malcolm Jamal Warner's Art in Motion Juneteenth performance at the Orchestra Hall in Minneapolis on June 23, 2023.
What happens to unhealed souls left to linger in bodies that hold on to trauma? The immortal imprisoned by mortals who thrive on fears stoked by lies. And where do those souls go when the trauma is intergenerational? We wear oppression so well, sometimes it's hard to tell if we know we're being oppressed. We wear stress like it's tailor fit with a passion that becomes so fashion legit that it's marketed to make the world crave it. As we swing low, sing hymns, throw rims on sweet chariots, boil chitlins, pickle pig feet. We beat drums, dance jigs, spit intricate anti-black misogynistic rhetoric over beats that bang harder than the hardest ghetto gangs. For what else would we do with the pain? And the pangs that come with sustained and prolonged dehumanizing debasement, degraded to a subhuman status, diabolically designed for self-hate, but where disgrace has never been an option. We even face fear with such defiance. Shackles and chains were the only way to try to tame the flame of our ancestral beast born in the wild. Flip forward 400 pages to view how the cages have become more sophisticated, how red lines decorate maps like graffiti to dictate dominions that dampen desires. But those ancestral fires defy suffocation. Stepped on, but not stamped out. Our spirits continue to dance through subjugation at every junction on our traumatic journey. We transform pain into celebratory mode, communicate code in a language colonizers can't understand, they can't decipher, but they attempt to copy because they know it's clever and cool. And still, we rise. Like embers in a wildly whistling wind. Like the love-struck sun chasing the coy moon. Like blunt smoke and our parents' blood pressure. We wear this oppressive air with such an impressive flair. Only the few astute, truly fascinated by the truth, dare view our struggle to survive as art in motion. For we are abstract, admired for how we create culture from scratch with scraps. And like indigenous land, we watch it get co-opted, ransacked, and raped. And then draped in lies of meritocracy to justify the equity gap. And we dance and we rap. You see, the art of being black is often an acrobatic act in defending black humanity in a world that worships a pale, long-haired Anglo-Saxon savior, even though the Bible clearly describes him as a bronze-skinned, woolly-haired Hebrew. And revisionist history continues right before our very eyes each time the importance of black lives is denied. What happens to unhealed souls left to linger in bodies that hold on to trauma? The immortal imprisoned by mortals who thrive on fear stoked by lies? And where do those souls go when the trauma is intergenerational? Uninformed race theory critics beget flag-waving parents professing patriotism who prefer their children pretend to be as blind to color as we purport Lady Liberty to be to justice. But she needs glasses so America can see how easy it is to be so indifferent to slavery when it's viewed solely as black history. But the holy truth is, slavery is white history too.
Was Malcolm Jamal Warner. In 2015, Warner received a Grammy Award for Best Traditional R&B Performance for his contribution to a cover of Stevie Wonder's Jesus Children of America. He did a poem on the track dedicated to the victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, along with musicians Robert Glasper, Experiment, and Lila Hathaway. Warner transitioned at the age of 54 on July 20th, 2025, while surfing in Costa Rica. May the Creator and the ancestors be with him. Say his name, Malcolm Jamal Warner.
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just because I walk as if I have oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like suns and like moons, with the certainty of tides. Just like hope springing high, still I rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes. Shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my sassiness upset you? Don't take it so hard just because I laugh. as if I have gold mines digging in my own backyard. You can shoot me with your words. You can cut me with your lies. You can kill me with your hatefulness. But just like life, I'll rise. Does my sexiness offend you? Oh. Does it come as a surprise that I dance? As if I have diamonds at the meeting of my thighs. Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain, I rise. A black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak miraculously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the hope and the dream of the slave. And so, naturally, there I go rising.
That was a classic by Maya Angelou, Still I Rise. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Houston violinist Michael Prince, The Emancipation Proclamation. Next, we hear a discussion featuring the beloved Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, formerly H. Rap Brown, who was one of the many revolutionary leaders of the Black Power movement. He was the chairman of SNCC and a member of the Black Panther Party. Imam Jamil Al-Amin transitioned at 82 on November 23, 2025, at a federal medical center in Butner, North Carolina, due to a reportedly untreated illness while incarcerated. His son, Kari Al-Amin, issued a family statement saying, quote, "On behalf of our entire family, I thank every single person who prayed, stood, marched, researched, wrote, advocated, and fought to clear my father's name," unquote. During a 79th birthday tribute to Imam Jamil, the Imam Jamil Action Network presented a short compilation of films, including an interview with Gil Noble, the Emmy Award-winning host and producer of the influential New York public affairs show, Like It Is.
Columbus was the 14th century, Joe Louis. He was looking for India. You ever dug where India is on the map? But understand this. America has the power to legitimatize anything that happens. They legitimatize his stupidity. And they said he discovered a country. How can you discover a country full of people?
We also recognize that individuals do not create rebellions. Conditions do. Until they begin to address themselves to those conditions, rebellions will continue and they will escalate. Sometimes the question has been raised about why black men fight and have fought for this country. It is the black man's implacable will to be free that makes him fight for this country. And it is that same will that will make him fight this country.
H. Rapp Brown was chairman of the young activist group known as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee during the upheavals of the 1960s. These were momentous times. This nation was being challenged about its centuries-old attitudes towards African Americans. And a variety of tactics were used to raise this challenge from a wide variety of black people. H. Rapp Brown represented what was viewed in white America as an extremist point of view. In truth, Mr. Brown and the student faction he was a member of began their protest movement against racism in most placid terms. It was only after the violent resistance that they were met with that their pronouncements grew angry, and H. Rapp Brown was its angriest spokesman.
Public education as it exists today is a weapon against black people. TV and news media, especially the WPP, White Power Press, White People's Paper, and White People's Power, are enemies against black people. What the white press does is that it makes black people an enemy of black people.
But that was back in the 1960s. What has happened to H. Rapp Brown since? Has he changed? What is he doing now? We'll find out in just a moment.
Welcome to Like It Is. It's been a long time, 25 years at least. How did you come to get the name that you now are known by, Jamil Alameen?
I seek refuge in Allah from misleading and from being misled, from betraying and being betrayed into ignorance by others. I ask Allah to guide my heart and to guide my tongue. And I begin in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Jamil Abdullah Alameen means beautiful servant of Allah, the trustworthy. Again, the naming is very significant. Naming in any society is significant because it gives one something that he aspires to. It gives a description as to what a person is. My name was given to me when I was incarcerated, when I was in prison after becoming Muslim. And again, the name Jamil, which the Arabic translation is beautiful. Abdullah means servant of Allah, and the Alameen is the trustworthy, which was one of the titles that the Prophet was known by, you know, trustworthy.
Was it in prison that you embraced Islam?
I became Muslim. I took a shahada, what's called the Declaration of Faith, when I was incarcerated, when I was in prison, when I was on Rikers Island.
And who bestowed that name on you?
There was a strong Islamic movement known as the Darul Islam movement, which was headquartered at Senate Inn at the Yassin Mosque out in Brooklyn. And they used to come inside the prisons to conduct the Jummah, the Friday services. So it was these brothers who came in, you know, and one of the brothers who invited me to come to Jummah. And I went several times before becoming Muslim. But after becoming Muslim, one of the brothers gave me the name.
Let's go back a bit. Where were you raised, born and raised?
Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
What kind of young man were you?
Well,
let's say as a student, what kind of personality were you? Were you athletic? Were you quiet, shy, outspoken? What kind of young man were you?
I guess, you know, some of all of those things. I played ball.
Basketball?
Basketball, football, and track. Was brought up in the church. You know, we were brought up in the church.
What church?
It was a Baptist church. My mother's church, my father's church for a while. And
really? Your father was a pastor?
No, not a pastor.
His church. Okay.
He attended the church.
Mm-hmm.
But the activism came through my brother Ed, who he's an older brother, my older brother. He became involved in the movement when he set in at the Greyhound bus station and was expelled from Southern University.
Where was this? What town?
This is in Baton Rouge.
Uh-huh.
You know, this was during the sit-in demonstrations. We had been active earlier just in the community during voter registration with the YMCA. But as the political activism, you know, that I was involved in later, had its bearing upon what Ed had done. I was still in high school. Ed was expelled from Southern University and later got a scholarship to Howard. But as a result of that, you know, I was propelled into a kind of activism in dealing with the students at Southern University.
Well, it's not as simple as all that. your education. You didn't learn much about our history in school.
Oh, no. I think that the only African-American personality that may have occurred in the books that we used, it was either George Washington Carver or Booker T. Washington.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was a total absence of any kind of African-American or black positive image, you know, for us when we were coming up as to the history.
So then, when did the political education begin, which precedes, I would think, mm-hmm. political activism?
Well, it was clear in terms of the kind of apartheid that was being practiced in the South and throughout America at that particular time. It was clear that there was an injustice that was being done.
We're talking about the 50s now.
The 50s and into the 60s. You know,
okay.
So again, it was a spawning ground for activism because people were keenly aware of the difference between, you know, the European community and the African-American community. I lived in Baton Rouge where you have Southern University and you have LSU. And I lived about a mile from LSU. So we would, you know, visit the campus that LSU had, and there was no comparison between what LSU had and what Southern University was. And Southern University was one of the better, you know, physical plants that African Americans had for a school at that particular yeah. time, but there was no comparison in terms of LSU. And just the things that was instilled in us as youngsters growing up in the South as a means of trying to survive, what your mother always tries to instill in you, to make you do things so as not to antagonize, to make yourself a target in a situation where, you know, African-American males were being killed. So these are the things that were prominent in the environment, but at the same time, as Allah says in the Quran, he says, fight tyranny and oppression, because tyranny and oppression is worse than slaughter.
But what I want to know is where it came from. I mean, if you were well... Mm-hmm. well-reared to be, you know, seen and not heard, respectful and all of that. Where did this spine come from? And what was the reaction on the part of your parents when they saw your shoulders beginning to square and your spine beginning to straighten?
Again, the Creator has placed within every person a kind of understanding of what is natural. He says, men are created on with the inclination to do what's natural. It's not natural for people to be enslaved. But again, even in the environment that tries to make this acceptable to you, you still have some resistance to it. And so this coupled with the fact that the movement was gaining momentum, uh-huh. the movement was gaining momentum in the 50s and the 60s. And so through media, you know, we saw images of people who were resisting. And within ourselves, we understood that there was a natural thing that you had to stand up at some time and say that, you know, we can't go any further with this.
The news media, examples of resistance that were happening across the country, what really jumped out and caught your attention in particular? Which resistance movement do you recall?
In high school, it was the time where the sit-ins, the Freedom Riders, the buses were being attacked, and the students, African-American students were going into previously white establishments and sitting down. And of course, you know, there was retaliation for them doing that. But at the same time, the Creator had allowed us to evolve in our mentality as a people to a point where even in spite of the physical danger, that was a time in which there was enough. You know, we had the people that, you know, I was a part of the group, we just had enough. You know, and as men and as people who were growing into manhood, we didn't choose to duplicate or to continue in the same pattern that we found.
So did you form your own group or did you become part of a wing of SNCC at that point or did that come later?
No, the SNCC came later. Mm-hmm. Because again, I was at Southern University mm-hmm. and SNCC, for the most part, was not a national organization in the early days. I later moved to Washington, D.C.
When you went to Howard, yeah.
I never attended Howard. I went to Washington, D.C. again. Ed was a student at Howard. Went to Washington, D.C. Ed went back to Mississippi. I stayed in Washington, D.C. But there was a group that had been formed around Washington, D.C., around Howard University, called NAG, Nonviolent Action Group, which was a kind of satellite group to SNCC. I became chairman of that particular group. And this was the occasion where we went to the White House and encountered Johnson and the other political officials at that time.
Mm-hmm. And what steps did you move to from there? Where did NAG take you?
I left Washington to go to work in Alabama on a project in Greene County with SNCC.
Uh-huh.
See, Ed, again, had gone down south to work with SNCC. They were doing voter registration. I stayed in D.C. for a few years, a couple of years, and then left, went down to become a part of SNCC and worked in Alabama.
So your brother was sort of a light for you to follow.
Oh, yeah. It was very instrumental in developing my political outlook and, you know, understanding.
Now, all this time when you're moving from Louisiana to Washington and from Washington elsewhere, you were reading and beginning to get a different kind of education for yourself, I would assume.
Well, yeah. Just being exposed to people who were in the movement, many who were well-read, and many who had begun to develop the black consciousness, the whole sense of African Americans and how they contributed to struggle and how they were instrumental in the struggle. And just in dealing with people and reading, you know, you begin to develop a different understanding as to what struggle was about and the movement, its relationship to movement.
Can you remember what books jumped out at you at that time?
I remember reading Claude Brown's book, which was in the 60s, Man Child in the Promised Land.
Mm-hmm.
Claude Brown's book and other readings concerning Nat Turner, concerning Denmark Vesey. There were other materials that were available. Again, this was prior to the whole black consciousness movement even.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, you still had the thrust behind it was voter registration and political activism in that field, that phase of political activism to register people to vote, to be a part of the system, mm-hmm. And to be a part of America.
Mm-hmm. How did Dr. King strike you in this phase of your life?
Well, we knew him, you know, as being a participant of the movement and had high regards for him as a leader. However, we differed on many different things, again, just based upon the fact that we were in the field and we were young and we were active. And so many times his understanding was not the same as our understanding. But again, there was always the mutual cooperation and respect in terms of the organizations during that time.
You met him?
Oh, yeah. I
dialogued with him about your differing philosophies?
Yeah, many occasions, yeah.
Okay. Now, let's get into SNCC. What happened in that involvement as far as your growth is concerned?
Well, again, I went into Alabama, which was just like Louisiana, as to except I was in the rural area, what would be considered the rural areas of Alabama. And we were organizing people at this time around the concept of the Freedom Democratic Party, an independent party. And
how large a cadre was this at that time?
With the SNCC organization?
You say we, yeah, mm-hmm. In that part of Alabama.
Just in Alabama?
Mm-hmm.
The state, the staff in the state was maybe 20, 30 people on staff.
That's
but,
all?
But then in each area, you had the auxiliary, the groups, and the people that you worked with, the people who resided there. Yeah.
Right. County in Alabama where you were functioning. Yeah. What did you do to sustain yourself? Where was the money coming from to keep body and soul together?
It's not just the county. It's the whole state of Alabama.
The whole state, excuse me.
The stipend that we were paid as staff was $5 a month, I think.
Yeah. A month?
Yeah, I think that was the stipend, $5 a month. So you had to, for your own survival, develop a relationship where with the people and organizing people where they would look after you, they would feed you, you know, and whatever else in terms of you could do to generate some income, you would have to do.
Did you ever get any pressure to stop this foolishness and going back to school and quote-unquote make something of yourself?
From whom now?
Pressure. Anybody.
Well, yeah, there was always a constant pressure of the older people of you know, parent and older people who felt that this was not necessarily the way to deal with the problems that were at hand. But again, the level of commitment that most of the people, the youngsters, had at that time was of such that they were willing to sacrifice. And many people began to understand as well that the system didn't work and it would never work. So education was not a tool that would bring about the kind of liberation that ultimately we understood that we had to have. Again, we began to see the educational process as being no more than a training process to keep people enslaved. And ultimately, we began to view the political process in that manner as well. You know, the question became, what better way to enslave a man than give him the vote and call him free? You know, we understood that in terms of that whole process of voting didn't have any benefit when you had to choose between someone like Bush and Reagan, Bush and anyone else who would be put forth as a candidate.
And so the thinking among this cadre began to change from one of inclusion into the status quo to other philosophies.
And it was born again out of the fact that we began to understand the reality of what struggle was and, you know, what the movement entailed, and that the resistance that we were meeting was not just a resistance, a southern resistance. It was not just in terms of resistance from people who lived down south, but in fact it was a part and parcel of what America was, that this was America, and America as it functioned had a quota which was not allow the majority of African Americans to become a part of that system and to function in a way in which they could get the full benefit from it.
That was Emmy Award-winning host, producer of the New York Public Affairs show, Like It Is, Gil Noble, who transitioned on April 5th, 2012. And beloved Imam Jamil Alameen, a.k.a. H. Rat Brown, who also transitioned at the age of 82 on November 23rd, 2025, at a federal medical center in Butner, North Carolina, due to reportedly an untreated illness while incarcerated. According to author and anti-racist activist Arun Kundani, quote, Imam Jamil is one of the great political activists of the Black and Islamic movements. His imprisonment was designed to make the world forget about him, and it has largely succeeded. In a statement after his death, his legal team, attorney Mawuli Mel Davis of Davis Bozeman Johnson Law, said, quote, after reviewing the documents and evidence, it became overwhelmingly clear to our firm that Imam Jamil Alameen did not receive a fair trial. Our commitment remains to make clear an undeniable record that he was denied a fair trial, suffered grave medical neglect, and was subjected to federal surveillance and suppression that threatens the freedom of us all. Saunders, Got to Have Freedom. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Akua Holt, with contributions by Fahima Sack, and edited by Akua Holt and senior editor Paulina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. When you understand your obligations to the Creator, then you can understand your obligations to society. Imam Jamil Abdullah Alameen.